we were in John, I brought two of just in or no, I only brought one commentary with me just in case, because it's the one that's four views. So it has the futurist, historist, preterist, and spiritualist interpretation side by side. And as I've explained, I'm kind of a little more eclectic. I think there might even be some dual fulfillments that we'll look at tonight, that it could be one or the other or both, and with regard to how this is, how this, especially these first couple verses, are interpreted. So, and they're both historical, by the way. They're both occurred in the first century. So, well, actually, one continues on, but began in the first century. So, let me get, boy, I didn't look at any of this stuff I got Sunday morning. So, let's see, Revelation 11. And now I did have the whole chapter kind of prepared, but I just know that it would take us a while to go through the whole chapter. Let me get a pen as well. Just in case. Boy, I'm not prepared. Okie doke. Okay, so let's read the first couple verses. Actually, we'll go ahead and read the first six verses. I'm not going to read all of chapter 10, but we have to understand these were not originally chapters. So it's in the middle of a context. And I'm reminded last week, everybody, that, you know, this is in the context. It is in this intermission, this pause between the sixth and seventh, not unlike the seals, but the trumpets. So 10 and 11 are linked together. So understanding one helps the other, or misunderstanding one will help misunderstand the other. So let's read the first six verses in chapter 11. So John wrote, "Then I was given a reed like a measuring rod, and an angel stood saying, 'Rise and measure the temple of God, the altar, and those who worship there. But leave out the court, which is outside the temple, and do not measure it, for it has been given to the Gentiles, and they will tread the holy city underfoot for 42 months. And I will give power to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth. These are the two olive trees and the two lampstands standing before the God of the earth. And if anyone wants to harm them, fire proceeds from their mouth and devours their enemies. And if anyone wants to harm them, he must be killed in this manner. These have power to shut heaven so that no rain falls in the days of their prophecy. And they have the power over waters to turn them to blood and to strike the earth with all plagues as often as they desire.'" So let me just give you a quick intro to this, or I don't know if it's an intro, but a little anecdote. Years ago, I was watching one of the Left Behind movies, and I don't even know if I was watching the whole thing, but I was scrolling through or whatever, and I literally saw two people going through the streets breathing fire, like they literally, like they were flamethrowers out of their mouths and killing people. And I'm like, no, that is a misunderstanding of the apocalypse, of this revelation. This is a vision, and we are not to take these things in a wooden literal sense. No more than we are to see a dragon or a dragon spewing out a river of flood that's drowning people. This is a misunderstanding. Okay, I think there's at least two or three that are possible interpretations of this vision. And in fact, there could be a little bit of overlap where more than one is actually intended. But I'm sure that two people, two individuals walking around the streets of Jerusalem and just killing people with fire is not what John intended. Okay? And why? Because I've read the rest of my Bible. Because I know what witnesses is, because witnesses are always in two. Because I understand what the temple is communicated as this Ezekiel's temple that was measured, not unlike this temple here. Ezekiel's temple was measured, but unlike Ezekiel's temple, there was some is left out here. So it would immediately, to the Jew, which if they're a true Hebrew, they're biblically literate. Right? And to the biblically literate Hebrew, Ezekiel would certainly, I mean, the first verse, Ezekiel would come right into mind. It would be, again, I always use this illustration because it's helpful, but it would be, I know how to get your mind to go to, well, let me just say it. Does anyone remember where they were when the two towers fell? Every single person shook their head. How do you know what I'm talking about? I didn't say 20 years ago. I didn't say New York City. I didn't say terrorists. I didn't say the World Trade Center. But every one of you, see, you all knew that. And when John said the two witnesses, when John, he even explains, these are the lampstands. These are the olive trees. These are the, you know, everything. Zechariah 4 floods into the Jewish mind, just like the World Trade Center flooded into your mind. When he talks about measuring a temple, only in Ezekiel has that ever happened, right? And it was a future temple. It was not the temple that Herod had rebuilt and refurbished and expanded to the temple complex. It was the future. It was the eschatological temple. And I know it's because I'm fighting 20th and 21st century Western Christians on this. Now, I wouldn't have to do all this if I was in the East. But because we've been invaded by this newspaper eschatology and a hard wooden literal sense of interpreting the Scripture, in the most symbolic book in all of Scripture, mind you, that I wouldn't have to do this, but that is the reason I'm saying there are, I've got probably 3 to 4 dozen commentaries on Revelation. Not one of them would suggest that this was two literal people with flamethrowers coming out of their mouth. Now, even those who do say that they might be two people, you know who the two people are? Paul and Peter. And they wouldn't be having flamethrowers for mouths. Well, let's just go into it because, again, I need to get through where we're at. So, let's see, I'm at H, right? Is that where we're at? At H? Oh, why did I put start here? 5 measuring the 2. Oh, I may have added a couple things. But let me just read this. But yeah, and then we'll get to where I was. So, all 5 descriptions, measuring, temple, altar, outer court, and holy city in 11, 1 through 2. I'm just going to read this, so just sit back and enjoy. This is a quote from a commentary. All those five measuring descriptions are likely figurative and applicable to the believing community that has precedent in 3:12, where, guess, get this, where it's spelled out that this is a community. Okay? Pillars, altars, all that. I mean, like, it literally, John says that you will, if you're faithful, you will be a pillar in the temple of God. How can I be a pillar in a temple? Are you going to turn me into stone? It's going to be a really short temple too, by the way, because I'm only, 6 foot. So when I put up my hands, 7, 8 feet, I mean, it's going to be so. No, obviously this is not a hyper-literalistic intent. So it says he who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem. The New Jerusalem is not a place for God's people. It is God's people with God dwelling in them and with them. The New Jerusalem, why does it say the New Jerusalem comes down from heaven? In another place, Paul says that the saints, the redeemed, will return with Christ. We are the New Jerusalem. Why is the New Jerusalem called a city, but it's also called a bride? Who is the bride of Christ? We are. Folks, this cannot be spelled out any more clearly. Let me just finish this quote. I interjected. So, where five similar images are figuratively applied to overcomers, namely pillar, temple, God's name, the name of the city of Jerusalem, and Christ's new name. The names of God and of Christ on the believer indicate that the believers dwell in the tabernacling presence of God and Christ, who are the true temple. See again, 21:22. I just mentioned it. With which believers are also identified as pillars. But why two witnesses? Okay, Terry actually answered this question last Wednesday evening. Not that anybody asked it, but he was answering it. But why two witnesses? The Old Testament required two witnesses to establish an offense against the law. Jesus also used the same principle, and I'm skipping all of the references, Old and New Testaments, where there are 35 or 36 in some manuscripts, groups of two witnesses, John 8:17. Also did Paul, 2 Corinthians 13 and 1 Timothy 5. God sent two angels to testify to the truth of the resurrection, Luke 24:4. And to the fact that Jesus would return, Acts 1:10-11, above all, only two. This is interesting too. I had not thought of this. Above all, only two of the seven churches. Remember all those churches that got scathed in Revelation out of the seven churches? Well, there was only two churches that represented the faithful church. And that they are in mind, and that they are in mind is apparent from the identification of the prophetic witnesses here as lamp stands. Okay, so this is putting the pieces of reverse. Just read the same letter that didn't have chapters in it, right? Just go back in the same letter, and it explained that they are lamp stands. Thus, there is pictured here the faithful remnant church who witnesses the two witnesses. Are not individuals, but represent the church universal. Indeed, the dual kingly priestly role of corporate church has already been explicitly affirmed in 1:6 and 5:10, and will be again in 26. The broader context of Zechariah 4 shows the richness of the connection to the present context. First, in Zechariah 1:16-17 and 2:1-5, an angel measures Jerusalem to signify that it will surely be reestablished in order that God's house will be built in it and that God will be the glory in her midst. The measuring of the temple in these two verses But second, Satan, together with the world powers opposed to the reestablishment of God's temple in Jerusalem, and that's also in Zechariah 3 and 4, as the beast and the world oppose the witnesses. And we see that again in verses 5 through 10 in this chapter. So with that, I changed point two to, well, no, not point three is the one I changed, but their security that they are invincible until their witness is done. Folks, this is another reason why we are to see this as the corporate church. Satan can't take us out. The world can't take us out. They can persecute us, but they can't do anything without God's say. And then it was their vulnerability was their old point. And then I put their phony because this is a newer persuasion of mine. See, thing about me is when it comes to this stuff like eschatology, I kind of sometimes shift a little bit, which is I see no problem in that because I'm going to follow my convictions. I'm going to follow wherever the most evidence is that I'm persuaded. And sometimes I'm like, well, can I just believe in both? and so I'm kind of like, if they could make a new category, I would be like half post-millennial, which is like Doug Wilson, and then half amillennial, which is like Sam Storms and Riddlebarger and some others that may not like that term, but I know like Alistair Begg, I mean, when I hear him preach, he sounds a lot all millennial. In fact, I got a book that he recommended that is pretty much that. So, what I've got here in verse 2 is they're phony, but so what is this measure, the inside, the altar, you know, like the Holy of Holies, the altar, and the people that worship there. Measure them, secure them, mark them off, distinguish them from the rest. But what about the outer court? Well, and again, it could be one or the other. So let me just tell you, the outer court could be the very same church that we were talking about. Again, there's so much I could read. There's hundreds of pages I could read that are very persuasive that this is the two witnesses represent the church. Okay? So, it could represent the church. Well, if it does represent the church, and then you don't want to see a distinction, you don't want to see a distinction from the church and the outer court, then you can say, well, the outer court is also a part of the temple complex. Ipso facto, it's a part of the church, but then it would be the vulnerability of the church. What's the vulnerability of the church? That Satan's going to conquer her? That she's not going to be able to overcome the gates of Hades? No. Our bodies. Revelation, in a way, you could sum it up as we win by losing. The people who are killed by the beast, the false prophet, the harlot, the people in Revelation who are killed are seen as conquerors and victors. They're vulnerable on the outside, but secure on the inside. Remember what Jesus said, do not fear those who can destroy the body, but fear the one who can destroy both body and soul in hell. You see, we're vulnerable from one aspect, but we are invincible from another aspect, right? So they would say the outer court is simply the Christian body, if you will. Now here's another one. The outer court, and I'm not so much persuaded by this one, but was the Jewish Christians who, although they were saved, quote unquote, they didn't listen, and they didn't listen to Jesus, who said, when you see the abomination of desolation, do not go to your homes. Run to the hills. John MacArthur and all of them are wrong on this because that has nothing to do with when Jesus returns. Running to the hills ain't going to save you.
Running under the hills ain't going
to
save you.
In fact, crying out for the rocks and the mountains to fall on you ain't going to save you. No, he was talking about first century AD, the temple and the whole Jerusalem city being sacked. And he said, when you see it approach, go run to the hills. Those are the only people who survived. And he also said this would all happen within this generation. Now, folks, if we're going to be taking the Bible literally, and you know your history, what happened within a generation? Those who ran to the hills survived. Folks, to me, it's not rock. This is not rocket science. Like Doug Wilson said, he goes, for the premillennialist who want to take everything literally, goes 42 months. He goes, what do you want? Egg in your beer? I mean, that's how long it lasted. I mean, what more proof do you need? Says Doug Wilson, and he's got a point. If you're going to take it literally, at least be consistent. When it gives you days, take them literally. Well, no, these are symbolic because it's got to be in the future. No, that is making your that is making the Bible bow down to your eschatological system. And we ought not do that. We shan't do that. And here is the latest, and I knew this. In fact, it was in my old notes from years ago. But this was one that after reading Doug Wilson's When the Man Comes Around, when his very brief and accessible, readable commentary on Revelation, I think he tends to think this. And that is that firstly, the term translated temple is naos, which refers to the Holy of Holies, where the presence of God resides, not outside it. And then let's read Hebrews 10, 19 through 23. Do you have that cued? Oh, that's A, 3A. If not, I can turn there. 10, 19 through 23. I'll race you. 10, I'm already there. 10, 19 through 23. So it says, therefore, brethren, having boldness to enter the holiest by the blood of Jesus. Who's entered the holiest? Well, he's talking to the church here, the believer. By a new and living way, which he consecrated for us through the veil, that is his flesh. Do you see how he's making these connotations? Right? We are going into the Holy Holies through the veil which he ripped, his own body, to get to the Holy of Holies. And having a high priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart and full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience. What did they used to do? Sprinkle blood on the priests. And you go, boy, that's a dirty job. How many times did they have to wash those robes? Continually. You know, you don't get all decked out and wear a three-piece suit and then throw blood on it and then just come back next tomorrow or next week with the old blood on it. Talk about laborious. But he says, let us, let me back up to 22. Let us draw near with a true heart and full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold. See all of these metaphors. It's so rich in metaphor. Folks, we use metaphors so much we don't even realize that when we're using metaphors. We just take it, you know, we understand. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful, and let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some. Why would they forsake the assembling of ourselves? Because of the persecution. Because if I assemble, I might die. And Paul's like saying, you might be vulnerable on the outside, but you're invincible on the inside. Trust God. He'll give you the grace or he will protect you. But exhorting one another and so much more as you see the day. It's like today. You know, I'm not begging anyone to come to church. But the thing is, if you can't be inconvenienced to come to church, then I hate to see, you know, I hate to see where you're going to be when they really start putting the heat on. Because if it's an inconvenience for you now, then it must, then you certainly don't want the persecution. And again, folks, if we stand, and pick up this book if it is in their language? Let's just say that, like in China, if in China where they're, you know, just not 20 years ago, and they may still be doing it today, they're boiling Christians alive in boiling water. And Muslims are killing Christians daily, hourly. And what I'm saying is in their native language, if they picked up the book of Revelation, they would get it before you and I would. Because they're living in the heat. The heat is turned up on the persecution to where it's literally life or death if you're caught worshiping Christ. That is when the lights will come on when you read Revelation. Because that is when this was written. I mean, this was, again, and again, some people may not agree, but I sincerely think they are way off. Revelation was written before AD 70. There's too much evidence, too many books that, to me, that is so persuasive. When you look at the evidence, it was written before. Again, how could you write a book like this on the persecution to come and not mention the temple? What had recently happened within 10 or 20 years. That would be like me today, just because it's 20 years. So that would be like me today writing a book of terrorism in New York City. Okay? 2023 and the history of terrorism in New York City and never mentioning 9/11. That would be a little bit curious, would it not? How, if this was written after AD 70, how is there not like a document? Why wouldn't there be a pointing back to it? It just makes no sense. This was written before. In fact, even liberal scholars who begrudgingly now admit that the whole of the New Testament, including Revelation, was probably likely written before AD 70. And they don't want to admit that. They want it to be way past. They want legend to creep in. They want eyewitnesses to be gone. Right? And again, there's the words of Jesus who said, all of this will not fail to take place before this generation. Again, take your Bible literally when he means, Jesus didn't say that generation. He said this generation standing here. And if I made some kind of prophecy and I said, my words will not fall and some of you still standing here will see it. Nobody would misconstrue that to 20 centuries later. Right? And by the way, Bart Ehrman prides himself. He's the like the dean of whatever, Bible, whatever, over in Chapel Hill. And he's an atheist. And he boasts about how his whole impetus, his whole motive is to get people, Christian church kids, to get them to discredit the Bible and to leave their faith. He wears it as a badge of honor. And he says Jesus proved himself to be a false prophet because he said the earth, the sun, the moon, the stars, and all this is going to go on. And it didn't happen. He said it would happen within a generation. It didn't happen. And I'm like, Bart Ehrman, you're a scholar and you don't know where that language came from? You ought not be teaching anything. You shouldn't even be teaching your kids or Sunday school, much less a whole slew of people's kids. All you have to do is read the Old Testament and you know that's hyperbolic language. That prophecy is used over and over, and Jesus just took the precedent and then he said that's regarding Jerusalem within this generation. And it happened, Bart Ehrman. It happened, which proved Jesus is the prophet of prophets. the most unlikeliest of all prophecies was fulfilled, just as he said. So, again, literal. Do you like literal? There's literal. But not everything is meant to be literal. If it's very, if it's apocalyptic, if it's major image metaphor stuff, it's not to be taken literal. So though they, the Holy of Holies, the altar, the people are measured and preserved, the outer courts were left unmeasured, that is, exposing to trampling with that of the holy city. So you see where I'm going with the second translation, and this is where I think I can have my cake and eat it too, perhaps. So if this is the church, these two witnesses, if it is the church that these two witnesses are representing in John's vision, and then they're measured, but the outer temple could be all the unbelieving Jews who literally stayed in Jerusalem. And what happened in Jerusalem in 87? They were trampled underfoot by the Gentiles. Do you see? For how long? 42 months. And here we're looking at the Left Behind movies and getting our theology. And by the way, what is the application? What's the application? If the rapture happens, then I guess we all get a second chance. We just really got to buckle down and get into the scriptures or find that pastor who was left behind because he wasn't really serious. He was kind of a believer, but only half a believer. So he was left behind. So he had the left behind. So he can explain to us, and then we can get saved. We get a second chance. Is that the application? Is the application that, I mean, I'm trying to think of what the application would be. It makes a whole lot more sense if this was historical. And it makes a whole lot more sense if this is speaking to the church to whom it was written, that you are my witnesses. Jesus said that you are my witnesses. I'm not taking you out of the world. I'm leaving you in it. If they hate me, they're going to hate you even worse. Paul says we're being killed all day long like sheep for the slaughter. There's application there to get courage, like in Hebrews. And there's application there to say that it may look like we're losing, but we, in fact, are winning. That's encouraging. What do you think the most persecuted Christians in places in the world, what's the most encouraging book that they could get? Joel Osteen's Your Best Life Now? No, it would be Revelation. It would be Hebrews. It would be 1 Peter. It would be 2 Peter. That is application. And maybe it doesn't, maybe because we're in the West, we're so pampered and spoiled that we just get to make these very sexy and sensational, fantastical, you know, futuristic interpretations of what all this is going to be. And man, I don't even read the new stuff anymore. When people say, oh, the prophecy's coming, this and that and the other. And back in the 70s, way before I was a Christian, the barcode was the number of the beast. Well, I guess we're all beasts, because it ain't not nearing one of us not uses a barcode, right? And then it was the chip under the skin, and now it's the currency, and now it's this, and now it's the shot and the jab, and now it's this, that. It's broader than that, but it was more honed in and more specific because the beast was Rome, and in particular, the beast was Nero. It was his nickname, not that he wanted it, but that was the moniker that those who hated him gave him, the beast, because he would tie people up to posts and have his S&Ms, his sexual fantasy, his perversions, and have it out on them as they were tied to poles, raping them and then doing, again, all of this sodomy stuff, you know, sodomizing them and all this stuff. He was known as the beast. He would put like the bear claws in a lion head or vice versa. Read the books. Read your history. He was known as the beast. So, but we want to make it Hitler or we want to make it. But know this, even though John had his name, and by the way, his name equated to 666. But that doesn't mean that there's no application for us today. Folks, I saw a correlation there with the masks and the jabs, that if you don't get this or wear this or do this, you will not be able to come in here and here and here. If you don't see a correlation there or an application there, then I can't, there's nothing I can do for you. But I've never said once that it was the mark of the beast. I'm just saying the principle is this: the state will always try to squeeze out the Christian, to squeeze out the church. Folks, if you don't know what the Congress has been up to the last couple decades, it's they would, if they could get away with it, what would be on the bill tonight, and they'd vote for it tonight, is make Christianity illegal. Folks, I'm telling you, if you don't believe that, then there's not much I can do for you. They are absolutely railing against God as they pretend to be Christians. It's deplorable. And by the way, that's in league with what? The false prophet claiming to be for God, but all the while working with and for the beast. That's the false prophet. And the beast, by the way, the beast is for us. Nero's not around anymore. By the way, there was also a Nero resurrection rumors back in the day. Right? But anyway, I digress a bit. But the beast is the state. It's like, you know how we say, fight the man, or the man, you know, give it to the man. The man is like the establishment, right? You know, working for the man, or this, that. You know how we say the man? That's the way they used the beast. It's overt. No one has to figure out, I mean, nobody who has their head out of the sand, nobody thinks that government's really public servants. They're in it for themselves. Special interests, their families, nepotism, all that stuff. Nobody thinks that everyone thinks, Democrat, Republican, conservative, they all distrust the government. It's beast, it's overt. That's why he's the beast of the sea. The sea was ominous, chaotic. The beast from the land, however, well, that's more comfy. You know, we got our, you know, woke pastors, comfy, the skinny jeans pastors and this and that, who are in league and with the beast, doing the policy, saying, yep, we're not going to meet. You're going to have to tune in on Facebook Live, or you're going to have to do this. We're going to have sermon, but you can give. We'll make sure that you can give, you know, via credit card and this and that, and the other. But, you know, we still got to make a living, even though we're not going to allow you to come in unless you wear a mask and have 6 jabs and this and that. And the other. Folks, they're in league with the beast. It's, to me, there's so much application when you read the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament. It just jumps out at you. And so does Revelation have application for us? Well, if these two witnesses for the church, if these are two witnesses are the church, then oh my goodness. By the way, the temple, when Paul uses it, when Jesus used it, Jesus first, by the way, in John 2, he said, destroy this temple, and I will raise it up in 3 days. Now, you say, well, that was a metaphor, but it's actually literal, isn't it? Because if his body is the temple, the place where God resides, and he resurrected it, that's very literal, is it not? Did he literally resurrect? See, he is the temple. Who are we? The body of Christ. We are the temple. Paul over and over again says it. We are not to think in terms of brick and mortar or stone and mortar. We are to think in terms of the body of Christ. And this is so relevant to that. If this is talking about brick and mortar, who cares? Who cares? Okay. So, furthermore, measuring some point out is symbolic action used to divide between holy and profane. Why measure the temple, the altar, and the people, but then not measure the outer court? Because it doesn't matter. This is more weight to Doug Wilson's post-millennial, more of a historist view, because preterist, historist, preterist, I'm more of a spiritualist preterist. But Doug Wilson thinks that yes, these are the outer court is the holy and the profane, right? And that's why it's trampled. And Jesus warned about it, didn't he? He said, "Because you do not weep for me, weep for your sons, your daughters, because you did not recognize the time of your visitation." And they were trampled. Jerusalem, the temple, 42 months. Further still, just as there was an interlude between the sixth and seventh seals, preserving the set apart saints of God, back up in Revelation, the 144,000. We see the same interlude between the sixth and seventh trumpets here, serving the same purpose, namely setting apart, i.e. measuring the saints, the true temple of God, whilst judging the unbelieving Jews, namely the outer court, which is also seen as the holy city of Jerusalem. My sentence there is trying to have my cake and eat it too. But I don't think that I'm trying to manipulate things into my system. What I'm seeing is I'm like, oh my goodness, that looks like that so much could be right. Oh my goodness, that looks like that's so much right because of the Bible and because of history. Could they both be true? In other words, let me repeat it again. Could that trampling of the 42 months, could that be both persecution of Jews that was to come through Nero? Guess how long it lasted? Approximately 3.5 years. And could it be also after the persecution of the Christians by Nero, the destruction of the temple also could have fallen under that? So to me, it's like either I'm going to flip a coin or I'm just going to flip a coin or I'm just going to set it on its side and say both. Both heads and tails. Now, again, you're intelligent people. You'll have to work through this out. And I don't expect you to make a decision. I don't expect to persuade you in one or two nights or even a. But the thing is I'm afraid that if those of you who want to do further study, I wish you would come to me so I could give you a bibliography, because I'm afraid of what you'll get. I'm afraid of what you will purchase. You will not purchase scholarly stuff that does the Greek, that does the true historical context, that really looks at apocalyptic literature in a realistic way. I'm afraid you won't do that, because I've read literally thousands of pages on this apocalypse, this apocalyptic language, the views, all views. And I'm telling you, the scholarly kind of stay in their pale. But what is not scholarly always is the sensational, and it's always in the future. I'm not going to dismiss or say that a premillennialist is not an acceptable view. Maybe there's even some of this premillennial interpretation that's still future ahead. And I would say, obviously, the new heavens and the new earth are ahead. Right, but all millennialists, postmillennialists, and premillennialists all agree that with that, right? Unless you're just a hyper, super, full preterist, and you think that it's already all been fulfilled. Well, that's not really good. That'll drive you to Joel Osteen. That's really depressing. I mean, boy, if this is all it, I better find my best life now. But not one commentary I have would adhere to that. So there is definitely future from now. Stuff in Revelation, but it's probably in the last couple chapters. And again, the application, even though this is much historical stuff, the application is for us loud and clear, because we are to be faithful in our generation and hope that the beast doesn't get crazy. Like, could you imagine if there wasn't like a balance? I know there's controlled opposition. There's not much of a balance of power. But could you imagine if literally Joe Biden just wanted to do everything they told him to do? I mean, you would have Nero or worse. Literally, if he didn't have the constraints of the Constitution. And Nero even had a Senate, but he was that limited him. But he was still able to do a lot of damage. So, We're about out of time. I knew. Let me see. Let me just read this next little paragraph. Finally, 11:2b parallels Luke 21:24, which predicts the punishment of the Jews. Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the nations until the times of the nations be fulfilled. In contrast, our analysis could see John transforming this into a prophecy of the persecution of the church, but both Luke's context and the synoptic parallels and Revelation 11:2 are developing the prophecy about end time tribulation from Daniel 7 through 12. In the synoptic contexts, that when I say synoptics, I mean Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Okay, when I say synoptics, because they're similar to the same, but that is the actual term that you, if you're going to, instead of saying Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you just say synoptics. So all of them, but I'm sorry, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. John is different. They focus more on general public ministry. You know, John focuses his gospel around seven miracles leading up to the eighth, which is his resurrection. But John's gospel is like these intimate conversations with Jesus and people one-on-one face to Jesus. Right? And it's stuff that the disciples were not even privy to until later revealed, right? But like Matthew, Mark, and Luke was stuff that was that's similar in many ways. They're again focused more on the public ministry, whereas John on the private. So in the synoptic context, the oppression of Jerusalem comes because of what? Jewish unbelief. But genuine believers suffer together with unbelieving Jews as in Babylon's invasion, as the Babylonian invasion and captivity. Indeed, one of the main purposes of the synoptic accounts is to prepare Christ's followers for imminent suffering so they will not stumble because of it. By the way, What do all three of the synoptics have that parallels? Well, Matthew 24 is known as the Olivet Discourse, but so does Mark and Luke. They all three record the words of Jesus when he talked about this destruction of the temple, not leaving one stone upon another, right? And interestingly, John did not. Again, he was focused on individual accounts and that we would believe that, you know, really revealing that Jesus is the divine one and all that stuff. But I'm of the opinion, I'm of the persuasion with many, many others that the revelation of John is the Olivet Discourse given by Jesus from heaven to him in the visions. Does that make sense? So that I am of the persuasion of that, because there's so many parallels, obviously. But we are out of time there. And do you want to open this, go back and have at least finish this two verses next week, and maybe even like have some more discussion and stuff? Or I wanted to let you guys chime in, but we just haven't had time. Do you want to, or do you want to just hop back on John? This all started because Wanda asked me a question one Sunday night, by the way. And so I pulled up my 11 pages that I had on Revelation chapter 11 and then added a couple of things and just kind of reviewed a little bit. But this, for those of you who were here years ago when I preached on Revelation, it's not unlike what I was preaching then. You know, I've consulted several other commentaries since then. But the ones that I had, I still think are really the best. I think I have the most scholarly.